going to start the podcast in a minute. You put that in your pocket. Attach that to your collar.
That's not a problem.
Okay. And this is this advances, and this is the laser. Okay, so we're going to start with the company Twist something?
Twist DX.
Twist DX.
And the first presenter will be Aidan Quinn.
Okay. We're going to just give a brief talk about recombinase polymerase amplification, which is, we thought, a very interesting technology that's used to amplify DNA from as little as a single molecule to trillions of molecules in as little time as 5 to 10 minutes. So the overall flow is really similar to PCR, and it's pretty easy to grasp. It's just the enzymes are switched a little bit. So the main enzyme here is a recombinase enzyme that scans double-stranded DNA, and when it you add in a primer, and when it finds a homologous region to the primer on the template DNA, it proceeds with a recombination event, and the primer is then hybridized with the template. And there's a single-stranded section that single-stranded binding proteins, which are included in the mix, can stabilize. So this is done at 37 degrees Celsius. And once the primer is stabilized, DNA polymerase is able to elongate, and the single strand up here is then stabilized by more single-stranded binding proteins. And elongation proceeds in this way. In a bidirectional manner, as very similar to PCR. This whole process then simply repeats itself. When the polymerase reaches the end, the recombinase scans again the new template DNA, the double-stranded template DNA, and can then initiate the whole process over again. So in this way, it's a reiterative process, much like PCR, but there's no wait time in between the primer annealing, and you don't have to wait for melting and annealing and so forth. What's particularly interesting is the people who invented this technology took it a step further and designed a way of doing a quantitative analysis. So this should be a substitute for QRT or qPCR. The way they had to do this was pretty ingenious, and this is probably one of the more interesting things about the technology, is they had to have a sort of a double primer. that are the two primers are linked by a THF A basic spacer, and one primer, the upstream.
What's THF?
I believe it's tetrahydrofluorine, which is a that's the common li- it's a relatively common linker. Is that correct? I believe that's what it is. But it's the purpose is it's an A basic linker that will allow the unit to act as a single unit when annealing to DNA. But an exonuclease gets stopped here. So the idea is that the upstream primer has a fluorophore attached to the 3' end, and there's a quencher for that fluorophore attached to the 5' end of the second downstream primer. And then these are linked by this THF group. When you put this into the process as your primer, what happens is the primer gets annealed onto, by recombinase activity, annealed onto the double-stranded DNA. And there's an additional enzyme in the reaction, this E. coli NFO, which has 3 to 5 prime exonuclease activity, but it's specific only for double-stranded DNA, and therefore you get chewback here. It stops at the THF spacer, and the quencher is thus removed. The fluorescence is activated, and DNA polymerase can proceed. The reason DNA polymerase doesn't proceed in the case where the double primer is attached to the template is that there's a 3' blocking group only on this second piece of the primer. So once the NFO chews back, there's a 3' hydroxyl that's available to DNA polymerase so that it can proceed. So to talk about one of the major advantages to this technology, other than the fact that it can do a full PCR cycle process in 5 to 10 minutes, is that the cost. This is a portable real-time fluorometer, is what they call it, that measures the fluorescence through time. And as you can see, it's only $4,500. But when you compare that to a QRT-PCR machine that's very large, and costs upwards of $40,000. This is a major advantage. And this is a sample output. It also shows that you can multiplex and look at different colors and different targets. To talk about advantages and applications, is Radhika.
So this process is I hope my shirt holds all of that in place. Yeah. Well. Okay. So what's really cool about this process is it's isothermal. It's at 37 degrees Celsius, and it's really, really quick. The bigger part of the advantage is that it can be used for detecting DNA molecules from like one DNA molecule or less than 10 RNA molecules to detectable levels in almost 5 to 10 minutes. Another advantage is that it's low cost. It uses simple reagents, which are unfortunately proprietary, so we can't talk a lot about those. But it's low cost, it's fairly robust, and it's, as you can see, very sensitive. Also, multiplexing, again, allows for simultaneous detection of multiple targets at the same time. So it's like it's a huge step ahead in the PCR that we have currently, which takes almost an hour, at least, to an hour to 2 hours to give like detectable results. It has a lot of potential applications, including in medical diagnostics. It has been used to detect MRSA, which is methicillin-resistant S. aureus. It's a very, very infectious strain of S. aureus that has developed in hospital settings because there. And the good part about or the bad part about it is that they are resistant to all kinds of antibiotics that are currently present. So trying to take care of MRSA in hospital settings is one of the biggest advantages. You can also identify a lot of other microorganisms. The research that was done on this technology involved Bacillus subtilis, MRSA, and a couple of other organisms just to detect them. You can this technology can go out into the field, which is a big thing because it's so small. It uses like small instruments and literally has a dipstick, which can detect the presence of the DNA molecule. So it can be used in agriculture for animal health checks. It can be used in biodefense and to detect detect the presence of anthrax and other stuff like that, like SARS. And that's also applicable in the food industry, where you go out to test the presence or quality control in bacteria. Also, the biggest advantage in terms of reaching out to the masses in this technology is that it can go to classrooms and basement labs instead of just being constricted to the research labs and diagnostic labs that it's restricted to currently. So, and of course, it has a lot of further application, as Aiden thinks so. So that's our company, Twist DX. Thanks a lot for listening to us. Do you have any questions?
Slightly greater than that of a normal PCR that's fully optimized, but for the purposes that it serves, I think they're more than enough.
So it's portable, but you need an isolated DNA sample first, right? Wherever
yeah.
Wherever you go, so you can't bring it to the bar.
You could absolutely.
I'm not trying to talk down. Just
no, right.
The thing is about. Another cool thing that I think we did not mention that about this technology is that it can be used without any sample preparation. So you can just go out there and try to measure even one molecule of DNA, and you can find it. The thing is, we don't actually know if it's the company's product that does this, because we went back to the research and we found that the researchers who actually developed this technology were able to do this without any sample prep. So
that's also true for any PCR, for TAC, classical PCR. You can just boil your source of cells, and it will release the DNA, and you can, with less reliability, but you can get signal. Well, sufficient isn't the problem, because you can go down to one molecule in theory, but let's say even 50 molecules. The TAC enzyme, and we're hearing also these enzymes, aren't bothered by all the other molecules that are present in a crude lysate.
Yeah.
I would take issue with one thing you said, which is that it's very simple, as if it's simple compared to classical PCR. I would maintain it's a lot more complicated. Because you have, in regular PCR, you have TAC polymerase, that's it. Yes, you have temperature shifts and more plumbing, but biochemically, this is rather complicated. There's no doubt it is super cool, but it is complicated. There's how many enzymes? There's the REC-A, there's the NFO, there's the exonuclease. Is that it?
Single-strand
binding protein, right?
So there's
four proteins.
Again, these are not like the intricacies that we did mention in the presentation, but the company has developed a fairly easy way to implement all of this, and that their products, the reagents that come with this, are fairly robust, and they are all like in dry, as dry products, are they?
Right.
And then, yeah, and so they can be like, the reagents are like they can be reconstituted fairly easily.
So they claim they're robust. Let's go back to the mechanism. Well, one question is, you don't have to use the fluorimeter. You can just take this, make your DNA, it'll come out a certain length depending on your primers, and just run it on a gel, just like regular endpoint PCR.
Right. And they also have, you referred to very quickly, a dipstick.
Yeah.
They have a dipstick that we didn't really present, and I didn't go over the whole mechanism of how it exactly works. But essentially, it runs the PCR, and if the product is there, it has an antigen that an antibody that's conjugated to a dipstick recognizes, and you'll see a band will appear on the dipstick.
So if you had a successful PCR, you can detect this, that DNA was made.
Right.
That's nice. So as you say, for field use, this sounds ideal. There's one thing I didn't understand about this. I don't have numbers, after all. Well, on this slide showing the fluorescence generation. So this top molecule is the primer with this interruption, with this difference in the middle, not an interruption. It's one long molecule. And you have the 3' end blocked, the 3' hydroxyl, and yet it's a 3' exo is able to recognize that even without the 3' hydroxyl, apparently.
I believe that's one of their proprietary data. Unless you're familiar with NFO, is that it? I couldn't seem to find it.
Yeah.
And then once you cleave that one off and start cleaving more, then you do have 3' hydroxyls.
Right.
Yeah. So wouldn't there be competition for then from DNA polymerase to get in and extend it?
I think that's where, right. I think
their reagents come into play because unfortunately we could not get into the details of what exactly they use and what the mechanism of their reagents is to control that last step that you see there. So we cannot really go into the intricacies of explaining you know, what happens there. But
certainly I would imagine that up until the THF point, that the NFO does indeed, for it to work, outcompete the polymerase, right? Because rationally.
So maybe they've developed a highly processive
exonuclease.
Right. Okay, thanks a lot. Still have one slot open for presentations on Monday. So anybody wants to do it, think about it, just email me sometime before 2:00 on Monday. Okay, so we're discussing RNA-based therapies and the sort of biotechnology of that approach to disease, and I went over the fundamentals of splicing, which is right now the major target for these RNA interfering with natural RNA processes. So I want to continue by talking about a couple of approaches. They're mainly two types. So you could think of at least three ways. One is if there's a disease that's based on the creation of a bad site, a wrong site, so that your gene expression is compromised by splicing to the wrong place. Then you could think about inhibiting splicing at that wrong place specifically so as to allow the normal splicing to take place again. And there's a fairly famous form of thalassemia, which is inability to make hemoglobin disease. There's many different forms in the alpha or beta chain of hemoglobin. And so that model system has been used for that, essentially using antisense against the splice site, the offending splice site. In many of these applications of using antisense, there's two major technical problems. One is delivery, and this is true for any nucleic acid-based therapy. These are not small molecules that just get into the cells easily. And the other is that if you're using RNA-RNA hybridization to block a processing step, the RNA itself is very unstable, and even DNA in the bloodstream, for instance, is unstable. There's DNases and RNases. And so for most products that are made, the nucleic acid, whether it's hard to say whether it's RNA or DNA in the end because it's so different, are modified so as to be resistant to enzymatic degradation. And I'll show you those modifications in a minute. Now, if you use, for instance, if your antisense is DNA, which is at least more stable than RNA, and it goes and forms a hybrid with the bad site, the unwanted site on the pre-messenger RNA, then you can also get degradation of the RNA, which you can't modify because the RNA is the pre-mRNA that's been transcribed of the gene. And so this is another problem in that RNase H, which is a specifically degrades RNA that's in RNA-DNA hybrids, will destroy the RNA at that point. And then, yes, you've stopped the splicing, but you've also killed your patient, your RNA, so you're not going to get your product. But this RNase H activity is not activated if you use something that looks so different from DNA that it's not recognized as a substrate. So that's another reason to use modification. If you look at the top here. Other cases, you might want to go in sort of more imaginatively and just get rid of natural products that are causing problems. This is especially true not for inherited diseases, but for cancer. So there's plenty of gene products that aid the tumor to grow, and if you can interfere with those by messing up their splicing, then that would be a potentially useful target. And in particular, there's a very tempting gene, which is the BCL gene, which exists in two different splicing isoforms due to alternative splicing, and they have just opposite effects on programmed cell death, and that one is a pro-apoptotic protein, whereas the other splicing isoforms, the same protein in a different version, and it's anti-apoptotic, not just not pro-apoptotic, it's actually anti-apoptotic. So if you could block the formation of the anti-apoptotic BCL2, then you encourage those tumor cells to go into programmed cell death. And indeed, the ratio between these two in favor of anti-apoptosis is found in many cancers. Then there's more less well-defined actions, such as mental illness just associated with certain kinds of neurotransmitter receptors. And they also have a lot of splicing receptors in particular, and also transcription factors have usually several different splicing isoforms. So again, if you can target the unwanted splicing isoform, you push splicing over to one more beneficial product, that would be good. But very few of these have been actually realized. One that's sort of very satisfying and has been shown to be effective in mouse models, but I haven't yet seen it in broad application in humans, is the case of muscular dystrophy. So in this case, it's not a splicing mutation that makes a new site, but rather just a nonsense mutation. So a nonsense mutation occurs in the middle of a gene, then you get a truncated form of that protein, which is generally it's a very serious mutation because you're only making half the protein or some portion of it, and so you're essentially null, don't have the function of that protein. If that nonsense mutation, which is in this important gene, I mean, it's been applied to dystrophin, which is the gene affected in muscular dystrophy, but there's a certain generality to this situation. If it's in an exon that has these two characteristics, one that is not absolutely necessary to have that exon, so why seems unreasonable, but in fact it is reasonable for many proteins that have repeated domains. And there's lots of proteins, receptors, and structural proteins that are like that. And so if it has, you know, seven domains all doing the same thing and all cooperating, if you knocked out one, only had six, you probably could get along. So that's true for this dystrophin gene. The second requirement is that if you're going to knock out that exon, what we're heading for is to knock out the exon that has this truncating nonsense mutation. Let's get it out of there. That exon has to be a multiple of three. About half the exons are multiples of three. You expect a third, but there's more than that. And especially in these genes that have these repeated domains coded for by repeated exons, it's often the case that they're a factor of three. So that when you knock it out, then the reading frame is maintained. So we'll see an experiment in which that third kind of technology has been used. But since these antisense molecules are almost always modified, let's consider some of the popular modifications. Here's a rather simple one. First of all, you can make nucleic acid, usually this is DNA, with one of the oxygens on the phosphate diester moiety substituted with sulfur. So that's then called phosphorothioates. And these are resistant especially to exonucleases. You can often do this for primers, for example, so that they don't get degraded from the 3' end, and they can still function perfectly well with their base for hybridization and for extension. In addition to using a deoxy here, which makes it more stable, you can also add various simple organic groups, such as this methoxyethyl. Methoxyethyl oxygen added onto here. So it looks more like RNA with the hydrogen substituted with a longer group, and that also imparts resistance to some nucleases. Then we can get more complicated. Morpholinos, and more expensive. Morpholinos, which can be synthesized, of course you have to be able to synthesize them to have a specific sequence if it's going to be antisense to your target. So these have to be synthesized just like regular DNA is synthesized. But now, in morpholinos, instead of a ribose, so here's our base, and here's our phosphate, and in between the two is normally a ribose or deoxyribose, so it's a completely different molecule. It's this heterocyclic ring with a nitrogen and an oxygen. And it turns out, after looking at many such trials with different kinds of substitutes for ribose or deoxyribose, that this morpholino ring allows the same conformation of the nucleic acid so that it can hybridize perfectly well with its complementary target. In addition, an oxygen on the phosphate has been replaced here not by sulfur but by an amino group. So you have the modified phosphate and this completely different compound instead of the sugar, and this still base pairs just fine. But they're expensive to make. And this is probably the most popular modified nucleic acid for antisense therapies. Then we get even more extreme and even more expensive so-called peptide nucleic acids instead of ribonucleic acids. And here again, the sugar has been replaced. Not only the sugar, but the sugar and the phosphate. So here, just for reference, on the right, now we do have numbers up here, so that's graphic 14 we're up to. Instead of a phosphate and a ribose in the base, we have this funny-looking thing, which has no phosphate, but rather has a bunch of CH2, NH, C double bond O, CH2, N, C double bond O, CH2, and then the base. So it's a peptide bond. These are amides, two amide bonds, and an extended, with extended length, which turns out to be just about the same length as you would have if you had the natural deoxyribose in here and phosphate in here. So this is called like a peptide displaying bases. And the amazing thing is that this sort of plastic RNA or DNA can hybridize not only well, hybridize even better than natural DNA to a complementary sequence. So it's even tighter. Then there's other little tricks like putting lysines on the end, again to stabilize it, or maybe in this case to get it into the cell. So those are PNAs. Okay, so let's go back to the case for some examples where you want to interfere with a bad splicing that's taking place. So Richard Cole has been a pioneer in this kind of therapy. Set up a system to show the feasibility of this kind of strategy. He took a GFP gene and put in an artificial intron in between two parts of it and splice sites so that normally these can splice just fine and you can get fluorescence if you transfect this gene coding for this pre-mRNA into mammalian cells. So then he took this globin gene that had the offending 5' splice site that was created by mutation to test it. And so since that's now has formed a good usable exon, that's the problem, now you get splicing according to the dotted lines below the diagram, the top diagram on graphic 15. And so you make a protein that's got some garbage in between the two halves of the GFP sequences and no fluorescence, of course. I shouldn't say of course, but no fluorescence. Whereas if you interfere with and to the extent that you interfere with this splicing, then you skip that exon. And because generally when you interfere with either end of an exon, the phenotype is exon skipping rather than intron retention of the remaining good splice site, that the exon as a whole seems to be surveyed perhaps as a quality control measure. This is true for most mutations, although not all, but most. So now you get fluorescence. And so he showed in cell culture that you could get this result when they add the antisense morpholino anti-globin sequence. Actually, this is not in vitro. This first one is actually the last experiment where they inject the antisense into the tail vein of a mouse that's carrying this gene. So first they made a transgenic mouse that had this gene, and now they just injected the morpholino RNA antisense into the tail vein. And then generally they give a hydraulic shock, like pumped some pressure so that the whole nervous system kind of got this push, and the mouse survives that, and they were able to get inhibition, a significant inhibition. These cells are pretty bright. And then they took out primary cultures from this mouse that had not yet been treated, and they showed that different cell types, both at least to these two different cell types, both respond, fibroblasts and hepatocytes from the mouse liver. And there's various concentrations of the antisense. If there's no antisense, it just looks all black, almost. And then even with nanomolar concentrations injected, I don't know what's that's as this is now in culture, so it's in the medium, 30 nanomolar, they can already see an effect, and that it peaks out at about 60 or 100 nanomolar, and actually at higher concentrations, it gets a little worse. It looks like. And if they use an oligo, the same kind of morpholino oligomer, but a control that's not targeted to the splice site, but 50 bases downstream, then it's ineffective. So they show that it's happening by the way they think. Yeah.
So the antisense is then just blocking the splice site?
That's the idea, that the antisense is just blocking. Whether it is or not, I mean, who knows? But it's designed to hybridize to it. If they use some other thing, it doesn't work. It's otherwise similar. So it's not some generalized inhibition of splicing. So it's consistent with it just blocking. Now the third way of that was the first way. We're not going to talk much about the second way, but the third way, which is interfering with a natural mutations that's truncating a protein, in the case of dystrophin, was described, 7 years ago. And I don't know that it's a standard therapy. It has been tried in humans, has some success, but it's not a general method. Anyway, dystrophin codes for a protein that is incorporated into the membrane of muscle cells, where it plays some role in stabilizing the membrane. The dystrophin gene, and it's always been considered the giant gene. I don't know if it's still true, but it's 2.4 megabases. So if it's not still the largest gene, it's certainly in the top three. It's got 79 exons. Even the mRNA is big. It's 14 kb mRNA. So it's a giant gene. Mutations cause different kinds of muscular dystrophy. This kind of mutation, which truncates the gene because of a nonsense mutation in one of the repeat, in any part of the gene, is called Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. There's a milder form, which is I think a missense mutation called Becker's muscular dystrophy. So. Not these people, but earlier, people had made mouse models for this and have replaced the mouse dystrophin gene with one of these mutated dystrophin genes. I mean, I guess both of them. Well, then bred it to be homozygous, so that this mouse now has muscular dystrophy because of this nonsense mutation. It happens to be in exon 23. So they can use this mouse now to test out therapies. They decided to use a viral vector to bring their antisense into the genes. So that's one way to get around this problem of bringing nucleic acids into cells that are charged and fairly long, is to put them into a vehicle that's used to getting into cells, like a virus. So this is adeno-associated virus, which is usually accompanies regular adenovirus during natural infections. So they're going to measure whether they get mRNA that has a skipped exon. They're going to measure whether they get dystrophin protein made, and they're going to look at whether it's going to the right place. So here's a picture of the gene, a little bit hard to figure because there's 79 exons and there's only 24 shown here. So there must be not the scale, and there's a lot of exons in this purple part now on graphic 18. And if we blow up this region around exon 23, so there's the real mRNA. Right? That's the protein on the top. Right? And the mRNA with its 79 exons is demarcated, is shown here. So here's exon 23 over towards the left. And it contains within it the nonsense mutation. 213 nucleotides long, which is a multiple of 3. And the way they've targeted it was to target it one antisense towards the branch point to the left of this exon, upstream of it, and the other part of this molecule targets the 5' splice site. So you can see the CAG, which is part of the exon, then GT, RAGT, that's the consensus. It's a pretty good-looking splice site. And so the so-called splice donor and the branch point is targeted by this antisense. They're going to produce the antisense, in this case, from DNA. So the virus is going to contain a gene, which they've engineered to have a promoter, which is for U7 RNA, which is one of the small RNAs. Some of the small RNAs are made in the nucleus, go out into the cytoplasm, they get modified, and they go back into the nucleus where they join the spliceosome and do their job or other jobs. But some of them just never see the cytoplasm. They're made in the nucleus and they never get out. So U7 is one of those. And so they thought to use the U7 promoter, maybe they would encourage this transcript also to stay inside the nucleus. To do that further encouragement for that, they incorporated, in addition to the regions that are complementary to the splice donor site, see in graphic 19 here, and to the branch point, they added a region which is a binding site for the SM protein. So SM proteins are common to all five of the subparticles of the spliceosome, so that U1, U2, U4, 5, and 6, they all are binding these SM proteins. And they kind of form a ring through which the RNA sticks. So there's a they put in a binding site for that protein to hope keep and target this RNA to wherever the splicing machinery is going. So that was a nice idea. I don't know whether it helped or not. They didn't say. You notice that they have one molecule and they have two parts of the molecule that they're targeting are on just one antisense molecule. So you could, might imagine if they both were binding at once that the pre-messenger RNA, or in this case this exon of the pre-messenger RNA, might be like looped out from these two, and maybe that's important. Maybe that adds to the efficacy of this antisense. So here's their kind of nice results. If we look at first just expression of this thing from the DNA, is it successfully expressed? They see that their molecule is a little bit higher than U7. They look at endogenous U7, doesn't seem to be interfered with. That's natural U7 RNA. And then over here on the right in graphic 20, we have after 2 weeks, if they added the recombinant virus here, they have nice big signal from this is like a northern blot, a nice big signal from their antisense RNA, right? And that's no greater after 4 weeks. So by 2 weeks, it's already quite high. And now if they look at my RT-PCR at this region surrounding exon 23. So if it's included, it's a higher molecular weight. So you can see at zero time, you have just the high molecular weight messenger RNA, which is going to be truncated because it has a nonsense mutation. After 2 weeks, you have less of that and a little bit of an RNA, it's a PCR product that's consistent with the skipping of this 213 base exon. And after 4 weeks, you have plenty of that and very little of the natural stuff. So why it takes 2 weeks, not clear, or even 4 weeks, really, to get a full-blown effect.
is not clear. It could be because the messenger RNA is extremely stable, for example, and so it takes that long for this included exon included RNA species to degrade. Right? They speculate. Then they do Westerns to look for dystrophin protein. This is a control. At zero time, they don't get any dystrophin protein because of nonsense mutation. After 2 weeks, they can see it a little bit. After 4 weeks, they get quite a bit, which doesn't go up after many more, up to 13 weeks still being produced. I don't know how long that DNA will last in there, and I don't know that it's integrated, for example, or what the status of it is. I don't think they knew. But in any case, 13 weeks is a long time. You could just inject the person again, and 4 times a year, not bad. Right? Now if they look at... I'm going to shut the lights off of this. If they look immunohistochemically, if you look at the first column, this is normal cells on the top row, graphic 21, and the dystrophin is the red, and as you see, it's in the membrane of these muscle cells. And the MDX mouse has mostly, don't see this red around their cells. But those that have been treated with the antisense, you see almost every cell has quite a bit of this dystrophin. That doesn't look quite as nice as the wild type, but looks pretty good. Then the remaining columns are other related proteins that are part of a complex with this dystrophin. And again, the wild type looks very beautiful. And in this case, the treated MDX mouse also looks quite beautiful. And the untreated looks much worse. I found this result to be intriguing. I've been looking at it since 2004, or whatever this was, May. What's going on there? You have a nonsense mutation that should be stopping the production of dystrophin, but that cell has dystrophin, even though it's got the nonsense mutation. I think there's something very interesting going on there. I'm not sure what. One might speculate that there's been a splicing change in those cells so that it's skipping that exon, just like in the treatment. It's skipping that exon and maybe some other exons. And that skipping gets positively reinforced. Maybe an epigenetic change. In 2004, I wouldn't have said that, but today I could say an epigenetic change. 2004 is thinking of some kind of feedback of the mRNA back to the splicing process. But today, since we know chromatin is actually involved in splicing decisions, there could be a change in the chromatin, which now is selecting against exon 23 and maybe some other exons, maybe by chance. And then, but why that should be locked in, I don't know. Maybe just by chance. After all, well, look over here, you have even more. This is less reliable since it's not dystrophin itself. But it looks like, 10%, 5 or 10% of the cells are exhibiting that. So. Could it be an artifact of what?
Yeah, because when you have this IgG, I mean, it can be, this is fluorescence, yeah. It's immunochemistry, but it's fluorescence available, right?
Yeah.
It could be an artifact because it what? Might be sometimes not specific, unspecific findings.
Well, if it were an artifactual cross-reaction with some other protein, I would expect a result that shows a dim outline around all the cells, not like one cell showing up.
Because the other cell looks very bright.
I'd say this is as bright as a treated cell, at least this one. This one not. Maybe not. Almost. But what I don't buy about the cross-reaction, why should this cell elicit cross-reaction and the one next to it not, if it's just a chemical cross-reaction? You'd have to say there's something makes this, there's making something other than dystrophin. That could be. It's making something other than dystrophin that now looks enough like dystrophin so that it's cross-reactive. Yes, so this is another possible explanation. That is not a switch in splicing, but a switch in some transcription factor, which is turning on something that now cross-reacts, but just in that cell, and then it gets carried on. Yeah. That explanation, in a sense, is a little more trivial than mine, and therefore bears the smell of truth. Okay, now we're going to talk about, I think I have to talk about RNA interference, RNAi, the general topic. I'm hesitant because it's this huge topic, and we don't have time to treat it. Oh, I didn't make time to treat it, because it would just dominate otherwise. There's just be tens of thousands of papers since RNA interference or siRNA, silencing RNA, was discovered just only about 10 or 12 years ago. And the nomenclature is very confusing. So I'm going to give kind of a, just paint with a broad brush. In other words, give you a rather superficial exposure, but at least better than nothing. So RNA interference is used to block the expression of specific genes, blocking at the level of mRNA, either mRNA amount by promoting their degradation or mRNA function by blocking their translation. This knocking is not usually called knockout because it's more of a knockdown than it's seldom 100% complete, unlike a mutation, which might knock out a gene, but it can be very effective. It also can be not so effective. It depends somewhat on the gene and on the quality of the interfering RNA you're adding. But it can be very effective, and it has been improved over the last maybe 5 years, so that you can usually count on being able to knock down the expression of your gene at least tenfold. So the different kinds of terms we have are siRNA, which, as I understand it, is just any kind of small RNA, the structure of which, well, I'll tell you right now, all of these have to be double-stranded RNAs. So small inhibitory RNAs, and they're double-stranded, and it's not at all acting by simply going in and blocking, as with antisense. So it's going in and being loaded onto RNAs by a cellular mechanism that's an active natural mechanism. shRNAs are short, SH stands for short hairpin RNAs, and these are usually produced sort of for experimental use by genes that make them hairpins. They have complementary sections that have a stem and a loop. And in this sense, it simulates the natural forms of the siRNAs. So the natural forms of the siRNAs come from microRNAs, which is still a booming area for investigation. And so it turns out that lots of small RNAs are made and then processed into siRNAs, into small double-stranded. Small means about 20 nucleotides. And that these small siRNAs originating from microRNAs that are transcribed from the genome go and regulate gene expression at the level of mRNA, the way I was saying. So it's a natural process and not one that's just invented by scientists. In addition to these small microRNAs that are produced off the genome, there's more recently been found that there's longer RNAs that don't code for proteins. And they're called, based on that negative definition, non-coding RNAs or ncRNAs. And sometimes they're lncRNAs for long non-coding RNAs. And their function is now still pretty much up in the air. One by one, they're being characterized, and they can have very, they have some diverse roles. They can even help organize chromatin. They can turn off and on genes. And so we have other levels of control going on besides this mRNA-based. So antisense, or ASRNAs, are something else. That seems to be just something that's more artificial. Why do we have this? One reason to have this double-stranded RNA rather than single-stranded is that it's thought to be a protection against viruses, which often go through a double-stranded RNA form. So I think something like flu, I think it's double-stranded to begin with. So the cell senses this double-stranded RNA and sends out and activates this destruction mechanism, which is called the interferon response. So there's so that's like another phenomenon that's going on. If you want to just introduce double-stranded RNA into the cell, generally it will get degraded, and it'll induce the interferon response, which will kill the cell. So the interferon response kills the cell and sends out a signal to the cells around it to also get killed because a virus has come in, and so we stop the virus. We sacrifice a few cells, and the virus isn't able to proliferate. But if you keep your RNA short enough, like 20 or 25, it will not trigger this interferon response. And this is only, I think, for vertebrate cells, possibly mammalian cells. So this is what I just said. So here's a picture, a cartoon of miRNA, the natural siRNA generator. So you have transcription. It could actually be something long. It could be from the introns of regular genes that code for mRNAs. And that part of the primary transcript, or it could be from intergene regions. It could be their own little genes, and it could be within genes. They have their own promoter. You make something longer. And then it's processed to produce something called the primary microRNA, which has a structure which has a stem, which is a key part. It's got a loop, and then it's got these tails. Then in the nucleus, so this is on the left in the nucleus, in graphic 24, enzymes called drosha, and it's more than one enzyme, but there's the drosha complex. Crop the tails off so that you're left just with the stem loop. That stem loop then gets associated with export proteins, gets exported through a nuclear pore into the cytoplasm. In the cytoplasm, a new complex is formed, which includes the key enzyme dicer. So the dicer removes the loop, and now you're left with just the short double-stranded, about 22 nucleotides. Double-stranded RNA, which corresponds to a region in the mRNA that's the target. So you have, lots of these, hundreds, right, if not thousands. And finally, you get association with this argonaut protein, and that constitutes this loading complex, sometimes called the RISK or RISKI complex, which is not shown, denoted here. And that's what loads it onto the messenger RNA. Once it's loaded onto the messenger RNA, you have two possible results. Depending on how good the complementarity is between this miRNA, what to call it, siRNA from the miRNA, if it is perfect without this bulge over here, then that triggers endonucleolytic cleavage at that site by endonucleases that are waiting and looking for this, right? And you get destruction of the RNA. Once you cleave here, you lose the protection of either the cap or the poly A, and so then you can get further destruction by exonucleases. They're just waiting. So then the messenger goes away. If it is non-perfect, with one or two mismatches, then you get a different result in that by still unknown mechanism, there's a signal that that messenger that's transmitted to the 5 prime end of that message and says, don't translate this message. I have this miRNA stuck to me. Don't translate me. And that eventually you get exonucleolytic degradation of such stalled messages. In vitro, then, if you're going to use these for treatment, now we can call them siRNAs, the double-stranded siRNAs, you can make the 2 strands, and then separately, you can make them synthetically, they're not that big, and then hybridize them to each other and yield them, and then add them to cells. And you use different transfection reagents that companies sell that are specialized for these small double-stranded RNAs rather than plasmid DNA. That helps. This is still kind of expensive if you're doing a lot of them. As a graduate student from our department, I went off and figured out how to do this. You make a long double-stranded RNA. Also, you don't know what sequence to make exactly. There's plenty of computer programs now that say, well, this should work. You don't want to try and target maybe a double-stranded region of the mRNA because maybe you won't have access, and so you have all kinds of predictions. They sort of work, but not perfectly. One way is to take the whole messenger RNA, make the complement, and then with T7, say, then anneal those to make double-stranded, then chop it into pieces and see which works, and then see if the whole mixture works. So this is kind of a cheap and dirty technique. So you can also make the DNA and transcribe it into RNA such that it has complementary sequence, so it's very much like the natural intermediate of microRNA, and then that will get converted to siRNA and used in the cell with either perfect or not. And or you can use the if your target is susceptible to natural microRNA, you can just use the microRNA itself sequence transcribed from a PCR product with the T7 promoter. Right? So these are the in vitro generations. And you can add all these, you could add them to the cells. So you have a delivery problem, you're going to use it therapeutically. All right, a few more words there. Not that useful. Or you can put DNA into the cell. You put the DNA into the cell that's coding for an shRNA. And let the cell make, instead of this T7 business in the test tube, you put the DNA in the cell. It could even be integrated into certain scenarios. And then that has the advantage, you don't have to do this transfection. The transfection will only last for a few days, and then it goes away. It's a transient transfection. If you put the gene into the genome and let it integrate, then that cell is always going to be making this siRNA, and so you have a permanent effect. Now, more recently, last 5 years, this technology is sort of gone genomic, in that you can make then these shRNA, shDNA, molecules, and you can make libraries, and we'll go through what this plasmid is in a minute. You can make these with enough complexity so that they cover all the genes in the human genome, or the mouse genome, or the C. elegans genome. So you could make, say, 25,000 of them, but you don't know maybe they're going to be so effective. It's usually more effective if you use more than one, because one may not be so effective, even though many have been tried and companies sell the ones that are most effective. But to be safe, you might want 5 siRNAs produced for every gene. So that means, 100,000. You can buy these libraries. You can buy each individual one on this list of 25,000 or 10,000, depending which company. Or you can buy the pool. What good is the pool? You can put the pool in. And then if you could select those cells, you can now sort of do genetics, sort of. It's incorporated somewhere. It's making an shRNA that stops gene X. You don't know what gene X is, but it stops them from from growing uncontrolled, if you could select for that somehow, or makes them grow uncontrolled, or makes them grow in this medium, not that, I mean, you know, makes them make a lot of fat or not. So you can select for a phenotype and then go in, because there's plenty of common sequences on the edges of this gene. You just PCR it up and see what you've got, correlate it with what's it complementary to, and so you know what your target is. So it's a new way, really, of doing genetics, which I'll probably have to spend more time on. So I want to go over the plasmid, because from a biotechnology point of view, it's interesting what they did. And this is just one company. I think this is, I'm not sure which one this is. Sigma is one of the companies. So they have here a piece of DNA that's taken from a virus, originally a retrovirus. So it's a retroviral vector with a 5' long-terminal repeat, and this is basically a 3' long-terminal repeat, which allows this whole thing to be transcribed okay. Then you have to look at this label. Okay, there's a central polypyrimidine tract. I didn't know that that helps translocation into the nucleus in non-dividing cells. It's usually a problem in transfecting, getting stable integrants in a non-dividing cell. But if you use these viral vectors, as we talked about earlier, lentivirus or retrovirus vectors, then they will integrate into even non-dividing cells. You have a zeomycin, which is a proprietary drug that's used for, it's like neomycin, that's used for selection of transfectants in general that receive the plasmid. Then you have this TET-inducible promoter. We know all about that. And it's making a transcript here, which has RFP, which is red fluorescent protein, so that you can track the actual transcription of this region, which has in it also the shRNA RNA part right here. And then what's this EBC promoter? There's a second promoter that is driving the expression of recombinant tetracycline TTA, the tetracycline transcriptional activator. So you have to have that special enzyme, you know. And rather than put it, the cells don't have that, so you're going to put it into an animal, you know, the animal doesn't have that. So they conveniently bring it in. They bring in the regulator for their TET-responsive promoter right on the same plasmid. Then on the same transcript, there's an internal ribosome entry site, which then promotes the puromycin resistance gene. And WRI is pretty mysterious, enhances the translation. I looked up WRI, I read somewhat about it. It's mostly a transcriptional activator for MYC. And I couldn't find anything on translation, but they're using it. So this is what goes in, and this is what they have, 50,000 of these things, right? Each with a different, differing only in the shRNA part. Yes, we still have 10 more minutes on this. Right? So we'll discuss that next time, and then get into aptamers. I did make a notation on the last box of the schedule, tell you something about the final. I don't want you to worry about all that purine metabolism. Don't waste your time studying that. I will ask nothing about purine metabolism. If I did, I would give you the sheet anyway. Right? So you've had enough of that. Right? And another thing is, and just again, judging from previous years' experiences, the last lecture is going to be on aptamers. So RNAs that have special artificial functions. There will definitely be a question on aptamers, because I've noticed that people drop off towards the end. So just because it's the last lecture doesn't mean it's not important. In fact, it will be important.